Well, a mandala, very much like what's called faith healing, is based on the idea that mind manifests in matter, and that as you change the nature of the vibrations or the nature of the level of consciousness, there are certain levels of consciousness where certain illnesses don't exist. And what a faith healer does is he uses his own vibrational rate to bring you to another vibrational rate. That's the way that process works. So these tankas work the same way. Well, a mantra works the same way. That is, it'll take you to its place. Now, there are mantras that are very strong power mantras. There are mantras for every particular thing you could want. But the only kinds of mantras that are primarily used in the West, and the ones that I work with, are all what are called general mantras. Wherever you are, they'll take you further on, right? It's sort of an infinite progression. It's not committed to any level other than the final level, which is no level. Om Mani Padme Hum is one of them. So that after you've been doing it for a while, it starts to affect your consciousness. It's just like when you do pranayama or breath control. After you've been doing the basic breathing exercises for just a few months, your breath gets very gentle and even. And instead of this type environment most of us live in, if you watch a yogi's breath, it's always just very faint, very delicate breath. And that breath is the environment in which your consciousness is living all the time. It's a very intimate environment that most of us don't notice at all because we're just so used to whatever our breath is. We think that's the way it is. But when we start to create that calm breath, it starts to bring us into another space. So that the mantra brings you into a space. Now, in addition to that, it serves as what would be called a centering device. That is, it's a place to make figure so that everything else becomes ground. See, here is your predicament. You are stuck, most of the time, just as I am, in the illusion. That is, you are attached to something in time and space. Or in another language, you're identifying with things in time and space. You're identifying with your body, with your feelings, with your mind, with your thoughts. And the idea of a mantra is that it just sits there and all that stuff goes by. It's like a bridge on which you stand looking down into the water in which you see your own life going by. It's a training device to break you out of your attachments. Like when I'm driving and doing mantra, question is, if you said to me, what are you doing? Would I say I'm driving? Would I say I'm doing mantra? Would I say I'm driving and doing mantra? Okay. Now, if I've forgotten I'm driving, and a guy who's driving gets tired and goes through the whole trip of driving, he's all attached to his driving. If I say I'm doing mantra, then just driving is just happening. So in other words, the mantra is a technique for bringing me into a place in myself which would be called the eternal present. That is a place where nothing's literally happening at all. Nothing's happening at all. It's a device for calming my mind. That's what it is. Device for calming my mind. And it gets so far out that after I did it for 2 days and two nights solid in Nepal once, I stopped to go to sleep, and of course it continued going. But instead of it continuing going just in my voice, it continued going, and now what it sounded like was a cross between the Mormon Tabernacle Choir and the O Heavenly Day Chorus. You know that? It's that huge thing, except it was made up of all old voices, and they were stretched back in time and space in infinite distance. So all I heard was, Om Mani Padme Hum, and the wind was Om Mani Padme Hum, and the air conditioner was Om Mani Padme Hum. The whole thing, I had tuned in on that place where that was all I could hear. But it was no longer my voice. And I went rushing into a yogi and I said, what's happening? I'm going crazy. And he said, you've tuned in on the Omkar. That's that place. You've tuned in on that place. There it is. That's where they're all hanging out. Sort of why I have all these pictures of high beings hanging around here. Because I know it's like the difference between reading the words of Buddha and the words of Alan Watts. I mean, Alan Watts is very groovy and he's a very high journalist, but he's not Buddha, see? And when you read Alan Watts, you're reading groovy things and a beautiful explanation for a layman of how it all is, but you're also getting all the reasons why Alan Watts isn't Buddha. See? Because he can't help but be his being, whatever that being is, and the being is that he's not Buddha. So that's what you get. It's like a typhoid Mary. I mean, you know, it's like... See, and it's interesting because my teacher is so far out. He's so delicate. He's a very beautiful Brahmin. He said to me, he said, don't eat any food that isn't cooked with love or with mantra. He said, because it will poison you. He said, because the vibrations of a person cooking food enters into the food when it is cooked over fire. Fire transmutes, it converts, brings that energy. Well, now, I can go into a restaurant along the road and eat something that is cooked by an angry chef, see, and I won't experience it because I'm so gross yet. My teacher would get violently ill. Even, and you will go through all of your changes about this, but even if the food were brought to him by a loving person and he didn't know anything about who cooked it, he would still get ill. Because those vibrations are as real as you get nauseous from the color green, or blue, or purple, or whatever. Or whatever your thing is. Now at another level, he could take that energy and transmute it, because that's the whole issue of transmuting energy, which I'll only talk about if you ask me. Okay, that's my introductory remarks. They can go on for the next 10 hours, I think you should know. When I first came back from India, I had so much energy. Of course, I'd been sitting silently in a temple for 6 months, you know, and all that talk I hadn't used, I've been using ever since. And I went to Wesleyan University to speak, and I started at 7:30 in the morning, and I ended at 3:45, 7:30 in the evening, and I ended at 3:45 in the morning. And out of 500 people, about 250 were still lying stretched out in the aisles, and we were all in this dark auditorium, and every now and then some more bit of something would come through, and we just got into a space. So.
Here an audience member asks a question regarding the benefits of psychotherapy.
The question is whether psychotherapy is can ready you or is a vehicle in this particular path or journey. Is that a reasonable way of saying it? Psychotherapy is just as high as the psychotherapist. If your psychotherapist happened to be Buddha, you would get enlightened in the process. See? And I'm not being facetious now, but I'm saying that it comes right down to, when you cut aside all of the melodrama, that you will get as free of your particular role attachments as the psychiatrist is free of his. See? Because if he is still attached to his particular role, all he can do is give you one role to substitute for another, which is primarily his. See? So that generally Freudian patients end up Freudianized and Jungians end up Jungianized. Now, most therapists have a model of what they think they're doing and how it all works. So, any data that's fed in from the patient goes through this model, and out comes a response consistent with this model.